This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, often reminds us that the number one problem facing humanity is the question of human survival. We possess the weapons to annihilate ourselves many times over, and the danger of nuclear war is so horrifying, we tend to simply put it out of our minds. But there are many biblical prophecies that are quite explicit in showing that it is a real danger, and it's one that we cannot ignore. There's an organization that keeps its focus on just how serious the threat of worldwide destruction is, and this week they voiced their view that the threat is greater than it's ever been. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, the end of the world just got a little bit closer, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. They pushed the second hand forward by 20 seconds on Thursday on their symbolic doomsday clock, and that brings the time to just 100 seconds until midnight. So it's, I guess it'd be 11:58 and 20 seconds right now. And midnight, of course, on this clock is the symbolic hour that worldwide nuclear destruction, or perhaps even other types of destruction, will happen. So this clock was created back in 1947, just after atomic weapons had been developed and used for the first time, and it's just a measurement of the likelihood that mankind will sort of succumb to his own devices. The farthest from midnight the clock has ever stood was in 1991, just after the Cold War ended, and they set it at 17 minutes till midnight at that time. So that was deemed to have been a comparatively very safe time. And then the nearest to zero that it's ever been before this week was in 1953, just after the Soviet Union and the U.S. had both tested thermonuclear devices within a very short span of each other. And then in 2008, the atomic scientist also pushed it forward once again to 2 minutes to midnight, as it had been in 1953, which we spoke about on Trumpet Hour at the time. That was when North Korea's nuclear activity was really reaching a crisis point, and as other global powers were planning to pull out of various nuclear weapons agreements and just growing more bellicose. And then the clock remained at the 11:58 mark throughout 2018 and 2019. But now, as of yesterday, the team behind the clock says the threat is even more severe. They say the threat now is unprecedented, and they're sounding the alarm about just how close the world is to destruction.
So you do have to give them some credit for at least keeping this in mind. This is something that a lot of people just don't really want to think about. But let's talk about the rationale behind making this move. Why 100 seconds to midnight now?
Sure. Well, the number one reason is just the proliferation of nuclear weapons. They point, well, here, I'll read a quote from it. It says, "An increasing number of states are obtaining nuclear weapons, including North Korea. And most recently, North Korean and American leaders have been exchanging childish name-calling and not-so-childish nuclear threats." So just a rogue state like North Korea being in possession of nuclear weapons, which have very recently been miniaturized enough to deploy on missiles, that is, I think, a legitimate threat that truly does bring a lot of danger into the world. And to have a firebrand leader such as Kim Jong-un, who has a fragile ego and who often saber rattles and threatens to use these nuclear weapons, that's something that they point to, and I don't think that that's incorrect, really, to call attention to that danger. They also point to the situation between India and Pakistan. Quite tense right now. We don't hear as much about it, but over what Narendra Modi recently did with Kashmir, a constitutional change there that really altered the freedoms, the autonomy that Kashmir once had, that has incurred the wrath of Pakistan, and both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers. So that's a flashpoint that they call a lot of attention to. They point to the South China Sea, which is You know, China, of course, is a nuclear power, and they're increasingly intent on asserting their will in that area. They call attention to the Taiwan Strait, which really could be viewed as a U.S.-China conflict, since Taiwan is a U.S. ally. So that's another Asian flashpoint where you have two nuclear powers. But there's also a lot in this report to disagree with. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, they're becoming increasingly leftist. They throw climate change on the list as an indicator that mankind's end is nigh. They talk about the Iranian nuclear deal and the fact that the U.S. pulled out of it as an indication that things are worse now than they were before, and I think that there's very little logic in that analysis. So not all of this is something that we would agree with, but I think that they still make some good points.
Yeah, like Jeremiah said, I think there's a lot of good points that they make, but it's worth pointing out that I think they suffer from a very liberal view of the world where cooperation is an absolute good. And so therefore, the more cooperation we have in the world, the safer we are. And so then they look at the Iran deal and they say, okay, we're cooperating with Iran, we're safer. They look at the various arms control deals that America has with Russia and says that, well, we're safer, there's cooperation there. And what's happened in the last year or two is under President Trump, we've moved from cooperation at any cost to a strategy of confrontation in some cases. We're going, you know, Iran is moving towards nuclear weapons. They're a terror-sponsoring state. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say they're an evil power. So we're moving from cooperation to confronting them. And the same with Russia. You know, Russia's cheating on their arms control deals, and this is something else they talk about in their report, where under President Trump, we've moved away from turning a blind eye to Russian cheating to confronting Russian cheating. Now, they see that as more dangerous because you've got an increase in confrontation in the world on those two fronts. I think in those two areas, we're actually somewhat safer. Totally not dealing with the problem, but somewhat safer because we've gone from cooperating with evil and helping evil to confronting evil. And so, and I think in those respects, Mr. Trump deserves some credit for making the world safer because at least he's taking some steps to confront some of the big problems that are bringing us to nuclear war. He's not confronting them enough to an extent that it's going to remove the threat of nuclear war, but he is confronting them.
Well, it is interesting, those the points that you brought out at the beginning there, Jeremiah, about just, first of all, North Korea. That's actually one that Gerald Flory draws considerable attention to in his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. As you said, when you have a rogue regime like that, that's kind of hard to predict, in possession of nuclear weapons and potentially using them. You also have a lot of developments in nuclear technology that could make nuclear war considerably more likely, and them being used more likely. It is interesting to think of this group of people that are examining all of these threats, and they're seeing, as you said, Richard, they're looking at some of these things that say like climate change and some of the more mainstream view on the way that these things are going to unfold, that they would view that as more dangerous in light of the fact that you have prophecies of. Like Stephen Flurry has his Trumpet Daily television program this weekend about sudden destruction. It will be sudden that it at the time when you actually have people thinking, say, there is more cooperation or people putting more faith in some of the agreements internationally, like the Iran nuclear deal, that they would put the day of Armageddon off. There's no one in this world who isn't looking at circumstances through any lens other than that of Bible prophecy who really understands the grave nature of the threats that really do face us. And essentially what that program is saying is that the ambassadors of peace and the people who are trying to make peace and trying to make the world a safer place are going to be frustrated by this inexorable movement of events toward nuclear Armageddon. So the conclusion that these scientists are drawing, maybe they're, some of the reasoning behind it isn't quite right, but the fact is we are closer to nuclear Armageddon than we have ever been, and it is something that more people should be willing to face. Well, we do have this article by Jeremiah on this specific subject, doomsday clock set to 100 seconds to midnight, the closest to Armageddon in history. That is up at thetrumpet.com. And I would also encourage you to look at that Trumpet Daily television program. It Will Be Sudden, airing this weekend. We also have that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. We'll put links to all of these things in the show notes for the program today. And thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Our minds have been on Jerusalem. Mr. Gerald Fleury is going to be heading over there this weekend to explore prospects for expanding our work over there. And right at the same time, it looks like the peace plan for the Middle East that U.S. President Donald Trump has been promising for quite a long time could be released within the next few days. To learn about this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So we do finally have a date, it seems, for this rollout of the deal of the century, and that is at least before next Tuesday. The President Donald Trump has said that he is going to reveal the details of this plan for the Palestinians and Israelis to have some type of peace deal before a visit of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and also the leader of the Blue and White faction, Benny Gantz. Obviously, Israel's been embroiled in this in the election season for over a year now, without there being a decisive result. And so you've had these two leaders that are kind of split the country in half, having received a lot of votes. Both of them are going to talk with President Trump about this in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. This past week here in Jerusalem, on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we did have the, I think it's the World Holocaust Forum, the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and there were world leaders in Jerusalem. Putin was here, Emmanuel Macron was here, Vice President Pence was here, and during a meeting with Netanyahu and Mr. Pence did invite Mr. Netanyahu to the White House for the unveiling of this peace deal. And the Prime Minister did then say, well, it would be good if Benny Gantz could come as well, considering a lot of Israel's population supports him also, to hear from President Trump himself what he plans to do regarding Israel and the Palestinian peace.
So we've just talked a lot about how big of a friend of Israel Donald Trump has proven himself to be. And we've also talked about the fact that some of the gifts and concessions that he's made to the Israelis may be setting them up for some disappointment when this peace plan is unveiled. And yet, it looks like the Palestinians aren't interested in this at all.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see all the details when they come out. From what's been reported so far, and there's only been a few little inklings of ideas in this, that it does seem it's going to be pro-Israel in terms of Jerusalem, at least. We know that prior to this, the economic package for the Palestinians has been rolled out 6 months ago, where they would be receiving up to $50 billion worth of aid in order to, if they do go ahead and sign this deal. And that will be funded by the Saudis and others. And so there is some motivation for the Palestinians to come to the negotiating table, because this is basically a bribe, a $50 billion bribe, to get them there. But we'll see. I mean, the details that have come out, it looks like this deal is going to okay an Israeli annexation of the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley is this area along the eastern side of Israel, which basically protects Israel from any attack from the eastern side. Israel knows that it needs to control that, and so they're never going to give away that. This is a something that President Trump sees that Israel's going to have to control. This is not the entire West Bank. This is just the Jordan Valley. It also, a part of this deal looks like it's going to be, is that Jerusalem is going to remain under Israeli sovereignty, all of it, East and West Jerusalem, which would be huge, because up to now, the American policy has been for Jerusalem to be negotiated by the two sides, the future status of Jerusalem. But now the U.S. position would be, no, Jerusalem belongs to Israel and the Palestinians can live there, but it should be sovereign Israeli territory, which could be very decisive in terms of why the Palestinians might not accept this at face value, because they want East Jerusalem. But also, it's, I think it's very important because it does acknowledge this fact that Jerusalem is central to Israelis. It's Jerusalem central to Israel's history. And it's something that would put President Trump on the side of Israelis, because most of Israelis believe that Jerusalem, East and West, should be sovereign under their control. But the rest of the international community firmly does not believe that. They believe East Jerusalem belongs to a future Palestinian state, but President Trump, it seems, does not believe that. And so this could be another indication of a split between the U.S. policy on Israel and the rest of the world's policy on Israel, in terms of President Trump favoring Israel over the Palestinians.
The fact that he's rolling this out before the election seems significant, that this could... How much does this bolster Netanyahu's bid?
I think it does. I mean, especially the fact that Netanyahu came out and said Gantz should be there as well. And so Gantz accepted to be there in Washington from Mr. Netanyahu's invitation to come. It paints him out to be the leader that's kind of negotiating this relationship with the United States. Netanyahu does. It does for Netanyahu, which would help him in the election. I mean, I think President Trump has basically said, we need to get this deal rolled out and we need to do it now. We can't wait for you guys to make up your mind as to who's going to be the leader of your country. This is so important for us. And so it would help Netanyahu. But at the same time, I think Gantz is aware that President Trump only comes around 1 in 100 years. And so regardless of who the leader of Israel is, if this is going to be good fundamentally for the state of Israel, I think that he's going to go along with this rollout, even though it may help Netanyahu at the polls, because it is bigger. It's bigger than just politics.
Well, it sounds like this coming week could be quite a week over there in Jerusalem. There's also protests that are beginning to at least build around the Temple Mount. And in the meantime, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, is getting ready to head over there in a few days. Could be an interesting week, given the rollout and all else that's happening here.
Yeah, it certainly is, I think, a very significant time for people to be watching Jerusalem. A lot that comes from thetrumpet.com is about watching Jerusalem, watching events here, as it is a thermometer for where we are in Bible prophecy. And it's also significant, I think. You have the President of the United States meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu and Benny Gantz at the very same time their editor-in-chief is in Jerusalem. And so, yeah, just keep your eyes peeled for the Trumpet and also just other worldly sources about events in Jerusalem over the next week.
We certainly will be doing that. Thank you for that, Brent. Germany is leading other nations to devise solutions to the civil war in Libya. But a conference this week in Berlin didn't go so well. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, we covered this last week, and I said we'd probably be back again talking about how the conference on Sunday went. They had a whole lot of nations congregating in Germany to try and find a solution to what is going on in Libya. You had major powers there, China, Germany, Italy, Russia, Turkey, United States, also regional powers, Algeria, Egypt, the Republic of Congo, quite a few nations. And the result was a flop. The leaders of the two different factions in Libya wouldn't talk to one another, wouldn't remain in the same room as each other. In terms of negotiating a solution to what was going on in Libya, very little came out of it. Russia and Turkey, two of the big backers of the two different sides, they both did agree to limit the amount of new material that they send to Libya. Whether they stick to that or not remains to be seen, and it doesn't do anything to withdraw all the existing weapons that they've put into the area. But... the critics have all gotten their reviews in, and it's one out of five stars. The Wolfram Lascher of the SWP think tank, he said that anyone who thought the conference was a success is living in a quote parallel reality. And then Die Zeit, kind of, they had a go at Germany. They condemned the German disability, and they said that Germany needs to be more muscular, more military, because if we're not, you know, then these kind of conferences, they're just going to keep flopping, because we need to be able to to show some muscle. And that's one of the things that's come away from this conference, is I think more at least talk in Germany and support in the press for saying, okay, the time for conversation is over. We can't fix this through dialogue alone. We're not going to sit down and round a table and sing kumbaya. If we're going to bring stability to this country that's sitting right to the south of Europe, that has the potential to destabilize Europe, has the potential to send huge numbers of migrants, potentially terrorists and terrorist material and arms and things like that into Europe, we need to do more than talk. We need to start sending soldiers into the area. In the wake of that, the European military stepped up some of what they're doing in the waters around Libya. It looks like, yes, the conference failed, but the result of that failed conference now is an increasing consensus within Germany that says, well, we can't just talk about Libya.
Well, that really seems to be the moral of the story with so much of what's happening in Germany these days, that what we're doing isn't working. We need more strength.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's interesting with Libya, where you can go back for several years and you can look at the statements of some of the people, at least the public figures towards the top of the army, and some of their top generals or some of the top politicians that are responsible for military affairs within the Bundeswehr, I mean, or within the Bundesparliament, and they're there talking about the need to get involved in Libya. They've been wanting to get involved in Libya for quite some time. There was one general a few years ago who talked about how there's a ring of fire across the Middle East and North Africa being caused by radical Islam, and we need to go into Libya. And you get the impression that the military is raring to go, and they're just waiting for the politicians to let them off the leash. And I think the pressure after this weekend upped on the politicians to let them off the leash. But then a point that Mr. Gerald Flurry made about a year ago in the cover of the Trumpet print is that, you know, that we may well not see any really aggressive action from Germany until you have a change in the political establishment, that the current political establishment is too weak to make that sort of change, and you know, we're looking for a strong man. But still, I think we saw in the wake of that activity this appetite in Germany growing and becoming clearer that they want to start going in and sorting out these problems, and they feel they need to go in and start sorting out these problems that really do threaten them from the Middle East and North Africa.
Bible prophecy shows that Germany does have a vested interest in North Africa. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So Daniel chapter 11, a critical chapter of Bible prophecy that we come back to again and again on this show, especially those last few verses from verse 40 onwards, where it starts talking about the time of the end. And it talks about this epic clash that so much of these end time events revolve around, and that's the way that it sets it up. This is one of the major events of at the time of the end, as it talks about there. And you've got these two powers, the king of the north and the king of the south, and you can see the outlines of both of these powers already. You see a king of the south of radical Islam led by Iran that's been taking over the Middle East. And that's just become clearer and clearer in recent years. You see the king of the north, this European power. It's not referring to America, because they're the descendants of Israel. They're talked about separately in Bible prophecy. It's not talking about Russia and China. They're talked about separately as in Bible prophecy. So it's talking about this European power. And it talks about those two clashing. And it talks about those two clashing specifically in Libya. It talks about the king of the north invading Libya. And by implication, that implies that Libya and Ethiopia and Egypt, three powers that are mentioned there, that they're aligned with the king of the south, they're aligned with radical Islam and Iran, and the king of the north ends up coming in and invading them. And you can see world events leading in that direction already. And I mentioned this article last time, but I'll mention it again in case you didn't get a chance, to go and look at that. An article by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry called Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. And I'd really urge you to go and read that article, because in that, he just really traces what we see right now and shows how it just was going to trend right. The events that we see right now are just leading straight into the events of Daniel 11, and then straight into the events that come right at the end of Daniel 11 and the return of Christ and that great hope in the future as well. So it's just, it's on a pretty straight path in some ways in the Middle East, and you can see the outlines of that prophecy pretty clearly already.
We will link to that in the show notes. And also, we have an article, Why is Germany Leading the Push for a Libyan Peace Process? That's on the front page of the Trumpet, and you can also find that in the show notes. Thank you, Richard. The battle in the United States over the Second Amendment and private gun ownership is getting very tense. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is getting very tense, especially in the state of Virginia. On Monday, they had 22,000 gun owners gather on the grounds of the Virginia State Capitol to demonstrate against proposed legislation that would increase background checks and crack down on gun ownership in Virginia, making it harder to purchase a firearm. And our Mr. Stephen Flory covered in his Trumpet Daily radio program earlier this week about especially just the angle of the media bias, how for days leading up to this this demonstration, you had all these media sources warning how this were white supremacists and white nationalists who were going to stage a violent rally so they can keep their guns. And I guess there actually were three white supremacists that were arrested before the rally began when the FBI found out that they had some intent to cause some trouble. But the 22,000 people who showed up were, there were white people there, there were black people there, there were Asian people there, there were Hispanic people there. No one got arrested. No one even fired off a gun. They even took their own trash out with them, which is kind of unique when most protest movements, usually the Capitol grounds are just a litter fest after there's been a demonstration. But very clean, very polite, just asking that the state legislature of Virginia not pass these new restrictions on gun ownership because it infringes upon the people's right to bear arms, which is what the Second Amendment states, that the right of the people, the people's right to bear arms shall not be infringed. That's at least the second half of the amendment.
Yeah, talk about these sanctuary cities and states and counties.
Yeah, that's kind of the context this is coming into is a lot of the people at this demonstration were actually sheriffs, and 91 out of like the 96 counties in Virginia have declared themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries. Where the sheriffs and the other local law enforcement officials have said that, well, if the state of Virginia passes a gun restriction law that's unconstitutional, they're going to have to find their own state-level law enforcement officers to enforce it because local law enforcement won't back that. I have a quote here from a sheriff in Grayson County, Virginia, Sheriff Richard Vaughn, who said, "If the bill goes through as proposed, they will not be enforced. They're unconstitutional. We swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Virginia, and that's what we'll do." And this shows that Virginia, this battle's one of the most tense just because the state legislature is passing some or working to pass some pretty strict gun laws and, like, most of the counties. Most of the counties have said they won't enforce them. I think there's even a proposal for a bunch of these counties to possibly join the state of West Virginia, which is more conservative. But even if you look at the nation as a whole, there's actually four states and 432 counties across the nation. So if you see that laid out on a map, that's like probably about 20%. Of the United States of America that has said, well, despite what the federal government or the state governments say or don't say about gun restrictions, anything that's not in line with the Second Amendment of the Constitution, the local law enforcement is not going to enforce.
Well, Stephen Flory talked about this on the Trumpet Daily radio show earlier this week, and when you look at the Bible prophecies of just how violent America is going to get in the time ahead. You see this face-off, this showdown that is progressing toward a violent confrontation between leftist lawmakers who want to strip people of their guns and gun owners who will have none of that, you could see this really blowing up into something very violent and really fulfilling those prophecies of the Bible of violence taking over in the cities in America especially. It's a very volatile, hot-button issue that really has the potential for tremendous damage to the United States. It's certainly tearing apart the social fabric of the nation, this battle over the Second Amendment. And it's important to watch this in light of those prophecies. And we will put a link to our Ezekiel booklet that talks about Ezekiel 5 and the violence in the cities in the show notes for the program. We also have an article that Andrew is working on about Virginia's war on gun owners. That'll be appearing on the Trumpet site very soon. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, how do you quarantine 19 million people? China is giving us some answers. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke in the first half about biblical prophecies of nuclear warfare. There are also prophecies of disease outbreaks. Right now, there's an outbreak in China that officials are taking unprecedented measures to try to contain. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, authorities in China are really sounding the alarm over the outbreak of a new pneumonia-like illness that originated in the city of Wuhan in central China. And from there, this illness has been spreading to Beijing and Shanghai and even to other Asian countries such as Japan and South Korea. New cases have been confirmed in the last couple of days in Australia and Saudi Arabia. And then just yesterday, there were reports of cases being investigated in Scotland, Texas, and Los Angeles, with individuals who were apparently traveling back from China that may be infected. So this illness is being called the coronavirus because when you look at it under an electron microscope, it has the shape of a halo or a corona. And at least 26 people have died from this so far in just about a month's time. And then another 830 are known to be infected. And that number of infected people is likely much lower than the actual cases. The Chinese authorities would have reason to try to downplay that. But the authorities do seem to be taking this very seriously, because the coronavirus, it seems to be able to spread very quickly from person to person. And so they have efforts underway to basically quarantine Wuhan and put the city under lockdown. And then there are several of Wuhan's suburbs that are being put on lockdown as well. So it totals somewhere between 19 and maybe 26 million people that are placed under travel restrictions right now, which is totally unprecedented, just a number like that that a government is trying to control and restrict from being able to travel. And then you have other Chinese cities as well that are starting to hunker down. It's the Chinese Lunar New Year right now, which is one of the most important dates on the Chinese calendar. And normally that means, I think it's 400 million people travel to another city at that time of year. But right now, many cities, even far away from Wuhan, are canceling their celebrations, and many people are deciding to just stay home.
What is the mortality rate of this disease?
There's a professor at Imperial College London who is studying corona, and he said that so far the death rate is roughly the same as the rate for the Spanish flu, which is around 1 in 50. And the Spanish flu ended up killing 50 million people. So a rate like that can really wreak havoc on a population, and especially when you consider how densely populated Chinese cities are, how close a lot of the people are to each other, mm-hmm. That could be just catastrophic.
Well, the fact that it's popped up in a few other places here, it shows just how high the danger is that a disease like this could escape the efforts to contain it. And when you look at what the Bible prophesies about some of the threat of disease is really wreaking havoc on the population, you see just how easily something like that could happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think for those familiar with Bible prophecy, the photos that we're seeing come out of Wuhan of these seas of face-masked people and just this chaos, it really calls to mind the image of the pale horse, or the horseman, from the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's written about in the book of Revelation, and it symbolizes disease. The first three are religious deception, war, and famine, and those four together symbolize the most destructive problems plaguing mankind, especially in the end time. And then Jesus Christ also mentioned disease or pestilence in Matthew 24, where he decoded really the meaning of the four horsemen there. And that's in the context of what will happen before he returns. So biblical prophecy does indicate that disease pandemics are coming soon. And with this coronavirus, it's hard to say whether the quarantine efforts will be successful, and maybe it'll fizzle out, but it is likely to be a super spreader virus. And so there's the possibility that this could expand and intensify and become something that is prophetically significant.
If somebody wanted to learn more about the prophecies, where would you send them?
We have a booklet written by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury and also with Mr. Wayne Turgeon. It's called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and that really lays out all of these Bible passages about disease in the end time.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. There is a lot of pressure on the United States right now to get out of Iraq. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was a massive protest today in Baghdad. 1 to 2 million people were actually taking to the streets. This is different to the protests that have been taking place in Iraq, where they've been protesting Iran's presence. That's when you've had protesters being shot. There were no protesters being shot in this protest because this is a pro-Iranian, if we can call it that, show of force that Iraqis want the United States presence removed from the country. Nobody was shot in this one. This was they were wearing white, I guess, as they were protesting a lot of these people, showing that they are willing to be martyrs for this cause, which is just really interesting considering what has taken place over the past 2 or 3 weeks after the death of Qasem Soleimani. There was that vote in the Iraqi parliament in Baghdad in the days after that attack from the United States, which called on the United States to leave Iraq. That vote, of course, was done only in the presence of Shiite lawmakers, as opposed to the whole parliament, which would have included the Kurds and the Sunnis. And so there is this groundswell of pressure from the Shiites in Iraq to remove the United States presence from that country. Currently has about 6,000 troops there. So now this proposal that is being put forward and is being spoken about a lot more freely than it has been in times past is for the decision to, or is for the option of actually dividing Iraq between a Shiite state, basically, which would be around Baghdad and towards the east of the country and the south of the country, and then separating some of the provinces in the west, in the western side, Anbar province, all the Mosul province up in the north, and the Kurds as being a separate state that is not run from Baghdad. The U.S. forces would stay there in this other state, and then you would get your Shiite state ruled from Baghdad, because we are seeing that Baghdad and the parliament and such, because the Shiites have majority down there, they are a much stronger force. And so now this proposal is being put out that, well, maybe this is a solution for us. The Kurds and the Sunnis are worried that they aren't going to have a say in the Baghdadi parliament anymore because it is so Shiite. And so now it's time to divide the country.
Quite a strong push and pull between the American desire to just get out of the region entirely and this recognition that an American presence really is necessary for a certain amount of stability over there. Just given what we understand about Bible prophecy and what's going to happen in that region, what do you make of this proposal, and how probable is it that this would actually take place?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this has been around, this idea, for maybe a decade, but the United States policy up to right now, it seems, has been to always maintain a unified Iraq, that all the factions are coming together and play nice. But Trump's a realist, I believe, and he sees that it's probably not going to function that way, that the Shiites are going to be in control, and that Iran is going to have the Baghdadi parliament in his back pocket. And so maybe this is going to get more traction. We already have a Kurdish, independent Kurdish area in the northern part of Iraq. And the idea would be for the provinces adjacent to the Kurds to then have a similar kind of idea at the beginning that the Kurds do, that they might not be fully separate from the Iraqi government, but it is on the way towards statehood. Biblical prophecy does indicate two things. It indicates that everything west of the Iraqi border is going to, it seems, fall in, out of Iran's favor, that is Syria. And then, but Baghdad and the Shiites are definitely going to side with Iran. And so the fact that you would have U.S. forces along this border between where Bible prophecy indicates there is going to be a division of alliance, pro-Iran and anti-Iran, Syria being anti-Iran, Iraq being pro-Iran, does indicate that it could happen. We are expecting some type of division between Syria and Iraq, maybe U.S. forces right there. As the president did say, he doesn't really want to pull out of Iraq right now. In the aftermath after that letter was circulated, that he was saying that he is willing to, he said that he doesn't want to. Maybe they'll just draw back to these other provinces that are bordering Syria. This could be something that very much falls in line with biblical prophecy. Either, whether this happens or not, the very fact that we have millions of people protesting the United States presence in Iraq, and that those people protesting are mainly the Shiites that are occupied, living in these areas on the eastern side of Iraq, does show that we are looking towards this split between a really pro-Iranian Iraqi state, perhaps slightly smaller than it currently is, and then people further towards the west, towards Syria, that are against Iran. If people want to understand the biblical underpinnings for this forecast, they can read our trend article on the topic. It's entitled "An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe."
Well, you definitely could see America taking this option as a means of resolving these tensions that would leave Iraq entirely in the hands of Iran, even if it was slightly smaller, something our editor-in-chief has been saying for a couple of decades would happen. So we will keep our eyes on that, and thank you very much for that, Brent. Whose fault was World War II? This question is still being argued this week between Russia and Poland. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is something that Russian President Vladimir Putin has dredged up over the last few weeks. In the past, he's kind of taken this view that when Russia signed a treaty with Adolf Hitler and the two of them divided up Eastern Europe between the two of them, he said that, well, that was a mistake. That's part of some of the Soviet crimes against some of these people in Eastern Europe. But in these recent weeks, he's dramatically changed his tune, and that ended up overshadowing some of the 75th anniversary commemorations of the liberation of Auschwitz that was taking place in Jerusalem over the last few days. So, you know, his new position now is that, well, actually, this deal that Russia made with Hitler, that's not a root cause of World War II. Instead, that, you know, Russia was forced into it. And they were forced into it because the West made deals with Adolf Hitler. And Poland also came to accommodations with Adolf Hitler. This is his argument, you know, that France and Britain, well, they signed the Munich Treaty, and Poland signed certain other deals. And so Russia was just forced into their own accommodation. And that actually, World War II is Poland's fault. It was Poland's belligerence. You know, they're kind of the aggressor, and he's trying to paint Poland as the aggressor and Russia as the victim of what happened here in World War II. And it's a weird story.
But it's easy to see why the Poles are pretty annoyed about this push to make them the aggressors in World War II. For example, you've got the Katyn massacre, where the Soviets rounded up 22,000 Polish officers and other kind of leaders in society and just killed them all because they wanted to make sure that Poland wasn't able to break away from them once they'd conquered it. And by killing all of that leadership, they made it much harder for Poland to be able to do that. So, you know, they were absolutely brutally treated. And this idea that well, the Munich Agreement was bad and the Hitler-Stalin Pact was bad, we're all kind of the same, is really poisonous. I mean, the West was foolish, and it was very wrong to sign the Munich Agreement, and it was a very bad deal for them to try and make a deal with Hitler. But the idea that that's the same as Hitler and Stalin sitting down and drawing a line down the map of Europe and saying, well, you invade here and I'll invade there. You know, the Munich was a misguided attempt to stop the war, whereas the Hitler-Stalin Pact was what started the war. And so this has caused Poland to pull out of the Holocaust remembrance commemorations in Jerusalem over the last few days, because Vladimir Putin will be speaking or spoke at those commemorations, whereas no Polish leader was scheduled to speak. So they said, well, this will mean that Vladimir Putin can say whatever he wants about this and we won't have an opportunity to rebut him. So they steered clear of that. But this is about much more than memorial commemorations and things like that. This is Vladimir Putin taking on much more aggressive language and kind of almost laying the groundwork for a Russian case of attacking Poland or targeting Poland. Now, you know, an attempt to paint even modern Poland as the bad guy. And George Friedman, for example, the founder at Geopolitical Futures, he drew attention to this rhetoric and put that alongside the changes that we've seen in the Russian high command and the way the Russian constitution and the way Russia is run, and said, well, is Russia preparing for war? Are they streamlining, or at least to threaten war? Are they streamlining their administration, like Jeremiah's talked about, and demonizing Poland at the same time because they're preparing to take action? And not necessarily to attack Poland, but to maybe absorb Belarus and then have to have this at least war of words with Poland afterwards as Poland tries to rally the world against them. So are they preparing for that? You know, maybe he's right, maybe he's not, but it's certainly very aggressive language. It's certainly very expansionist language to say that what Stalin did was fine and that Poland is wrong. And this characteristic of expansionism is one of the key things that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's talked about with Vladimir Putin. You know, as Jeremiah talked about a week or two ago when we were talking about that government restructuring, Ezekiel chapter 38 talks about, in verse 2, it should read, the prince of Rosh, of Meshech, and Tubal. And it's a biblical prophecy about a prince of Russia. But it calls him the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. It mentions the prince of Rosh, but then also these two different regions of Russia, of Moscow, Meshech, and Tubal, Tobolsk. And in his book, The Prophesied Prince of Rosh, Mr. Gerald Flurry wrote, the use of all three names shows that this is an individual of all the peoples of Russia, from west to east. The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days. This giant swath of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union. So a very aggressive, expansionist-minded individual. Other prophecies about Russia in the Bible confirm that. And his rhetoric about World War II and Poland now tells exactly the same story.
The Prophesied Prince of Russia. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks for that, Richard. In case you haven't heard, the U.S. Senate is in the middle of a trial to impeach President Donald Trump. This week we heard from the Democrats, and one of their biggest arguments was Russia. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it seems like it takes more and more to shock you these days, but I was even kind of shocked by this story, to where we're now on the third day of the impeachment trial at the Senate. And the head impeachment manager is Representative Adam Schiff. And he gave his opening statements yesterday. And in his opening comments, he mentioned Russia and election hacking at least 15 times, saying that we are here today to consider a much more grave matter, and that is an attempt to use the power of the presidency to cheat in an election. For precisely this reason, the president's misconduct cannot be decided at the ballot box, for we cannot be assured that the vote will be fairly won. Now, he's supposed to be talking about this phone call he made with Ukraine, and that's what he's trying to say there, is that he tried to use the power of the presidency to get a foreign government to investigate one of his political rivals. There's no evidence of that, but that's what he's being impeached for. And so now he's roping the Russia thing into this as one big part of the story. And you do have to wonder what his the end game is here, though, because constitutionally he's supposed to be trying to convince 67 senators to remove President Trump from office. That's not going to happen by talking about Russia rigged the 2016 election. We've been over that many times with the Mueller investigation and other investigations and found that that's not true. So you'd have to, you'd have to assume that Adam Schiff's smart enough to realize that he's not going to get 67 senators to vote to remove President Trump from office by talking about Russia. He's probably not going to get 67 senators to vote to remove President Trump from office by talking about Ukraine either. But the reason, it seems like the only logical reason he's taking this angle is he's not actually talking to the Senate. He's talking to the media and the American people. There's a statement often attributed to Joseph Goebbels, and probably a paraphrase from him, that says, if you tell a big enough lie and repeat it long enough, eventually people will start believing you. And the polls show that about 48% of Americans believe that President Trump colluded with Russia. I'm skeptical of those polls that it is really 48%, but I think it's safe to say it is a sizable percentage of Americans. Despite
no amount of evidence is going to convince them otherwise.
No amount of evidence is going to convince them otherwise. And if the Democrats give up this impeachment thing, maybe that can convince a few people if they drop it. But as long as they refuse to drop it, as long as they refuse to drop that ball, you've got a sizable contingent of Americans who believe it. And then just leading into some of the historic levels of division we talked about earlier in the program. Because we actually, Kia David, by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, this week is on will worship. And he talks a lot about politics in America, about just this believing, worshiping the human will, believing what someone says because they said it with no regard for intelligence, for no regard to reason. It's what you're definitely seeing in the impeachment trial, is you're getting, regardless of everything, you're still beating this Russia drum after... the Mueller report and everything have said to show that there's no evidence of that. And then the point is to, well, keep Donald Trump from being elected, or if not, at least put what they called with Brett Kavanaugh, the asterisk theory. It's like, well, he's a Supreme Court judge, but there's an asterisk by his name. There's always a significant portion of the population that thinks he's illegitimate and that cripples the effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up that Key of David program, Will Worship by Gerald Fleury. I have not had the opportunity to see that yet, but I really look forward to that. It promises to be a good one. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. When people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.